Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. In this critical election year, you count on Democracy Now! To stay focused on the stories that matter most. And we count on you to support our independent journalism. If everyone who tunes into Democracy Now! Signed up for a monthly donation of, say, just $6, we could cover our operating costs for the entire year. Really, that's all it would take. Please do your part today by visiting us at democracynow.org. Stay safe. Wear a mask, save lives, and thank you so much. From New York, this is Democracy Now! $750. That's how much Donald Trump paid in federal taxes in 2016 and 2017. He paid no taxes in 10 of the last 15 years. We'll speak to the nation's Elie Mystal. Today's other top story, the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett to the U.S. Supreme Court.
I clerked for Justice Scalia more than 20 years ago, but the lessons I learned still resonate. His judicial philosophy is mine, too. A judge must apply the law as written. Judges are not policymakers, and they must be resolute in setting aside any policy views they might hold.
Democrats are blasting Senate Republicans for racing to confirm Amy Coney Barrett in what could be the final months of the Trump presidency.
There's no mystery about what's happening here. President Trump is trying to throw out the Affordable Care Act. He's been trying to do it for the last 4 years.
We'll also talk to the head of Planned Parenthood, Alexis McGill Johnson, about why Amy Coney Barrett's nomination poses a dire threat to reproductive rights and the Affordable Care Act in the country. Then we look at how new body cam footage raises questions about the investigation into the police killing of Breonna Taylor inside her own home. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump announced Saturday the nomination of federal appeals judge Amy Coney Barrett to fill Ruth Bader Ginsburg's seat on the Supreme Court. 48-year-old Barrett is a devout Catholic who's taken conservative stances on abortion, gun rights, immigration, and LGBTQ rights. A former Notre Dame law professor, she clerked for the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. The Republican-controlled Senate could confirm Amy Coney Barrett just days before Election Day, as hearings are set to begin October 12th. Over the weekend, demonstrations were held across the country calling on Democratic lawmakers to do everything in their power to delay proceedings until after the results of the election are known. Meanwhile, House Democrats will introduce a bill Tuesday setting an 18-year term limit for Supreme Court justices. We'll have more on Judge Barrett and the Supreme Court later in the broadcast. The New York Times published an explosive report diving into over two decades of Trump's tax returns, which reveal he paid no income taxes at all in 10 of the last 15 years. The report also finds he paid just $750 in federal income tax in 2016, the year he was elected. According to the Times, Trump minimized his taxes by reporting mass losses across his businesses, including his golf courses and his hotel in Washington, D.C. The Trump family also reduced its tax bill by paying so-called consulting fees to Ivanka Trump as an employee of the Trump Organization. The Times also reveals Trump's been locked in a battle with the IRS over a $73 million tax refund he claimed after his casino business in Atlantic City collapsed. Trump could be forced to pay over $100 million if he loses. In addition, Trump has over $300 million in loans he personally guaranteed that will soon come due. Trump dismissed the New York Times report as fake news. We'll have more on the story after headlines. In Louisville, Kentucky, over two dozen protesters were arrested Saturday as demonstrations continue over the grand jury decision last week clearing police officers of shooting and killing Breonna Taylor, the 26-year-old African-American EMT, in her own home in March. On Friday, Taylor's family spoke publicly for the first time since the grand jury's decision. Bianca Austin, Taylor's aunt, read a statement written by Taylor's mother, Tamika Palmer.
When I speak on it, I'm considered an angry black woman. Mm. But know this, I am an angry black woman. Hey. I am not angry for the reasons that you would like me to be.
That's right.
That's right.
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. But angry because our black women keep dying at the hands of police officers.
Mm.
Black men. Mm.
This comes as new body cam footage obtained by Vice News shows police officers involved in Breonna Taylor's killing, breaking several department policies, raising questions about the integrity of the crime scene and the investigation that followed. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. Coronavirus cases in the U.S. have now topped 7.1 million, with nearly half of all states reporting a rise in daily cases over the past week and major surges reported in the Midwest. Despite the mounting cases, recent numbers published in the journal The Lancet shows only 9% of the country's population may have been exposed to the coronavirus, meaning the vast majority of people remain susceptible going into the fall and winter months. Florida said Friday it is fully reopening its economy, allowing restaurants to operate at full capacity, banning localities from ordering closures. In Virginia, Governor Ralph Northam and his wife have tested positive for COVID-19. President Trump repeatedly attacked the Democratic governor at his rally in Newport News, Virginia, Friday night, hours after news of Northam's infection was announced. Virginia officials had attempted to halt the rally, which violates an executive order by Northam banning gatherings of more than 250 people. In labor news, the airline industry is set to cut over 35,000 jobs by the end of the week, barring a move from Congress to continue funding payroll protections included as part of the CARES Act due to expire at the end of this month. In education news, New York City's Principals Union unanimously passed a vote of no confidence in Mayor Bill de Blasio, asking he cede control of city schools to the state education department for the duration of the pandemic. This comes just days before the now twice-delayed reopening of the city's public schools, which is scheduled to happen this week. The global COVID-19 death toll is nearing 1 million, with over 33 million reported cases. Latin America continues to suffer the ravages of the virus, with five out of the top 10 most infected countries. Mexico is the fourth highest death toll in the world, topping 76,000. Brazil's recorded over 141,000 deaths, second only to the U.S. Manaus, the largest city in Brazil's Amazon, reported a fresh surge in cases days after scientists speculated a recent decline in cases might be attributable to reaching a certain level of, quote, herd immunity. In Israel, thousands of protesters took to the streets for a 14th straight week to demand Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu resign, despite government attempts to quell demonstrations through strict new lockdown measures as it battles one of the world's worst outbreaks. Armenia and Azerbaijan have declared martial law and mobilized their militaries after heavy fighting broke out Sunday between the two nations in the disputed territory and the Caucasus Mountains. There are reports of at least 23 dead, over 100 wounded, including civilians, as both sides traded tank, artillery and drone fire in a region that's internationally recognized as Azerbaijani territory, but whose population is mostly ethnic Armenian. It's the worst fighting in the area since a five-day war in 2016 that left over 100 people dead. in Belarus. Police again deployed tear gas and arrested scores of protesters during the seventh straight week of demonstrations demanding the ouster of longtime authoritarian leader Alexander Lukashenko. He was quietly inaugurated last week, but both the U.S. and the European Union said they do not recognize his rule as legitimate. Critics say last month's election was rigged, and many of the leaders of the opposition have gone into exile. At least 16 refugees are feared dead after a boat capsized off the Libyan coast Thursday. At least 22 people were rescued. This year alone, over 620 refugees are believed to have drowned attempting to passage to Europe from North Africa. In Lebanon, Prime Minister-designate Mustafa Adib has stepped down after he failed to form a new government. Lebanon has been left reeling with mounting calls for reform following the devastating explosion at the port of Beirut on August 4th that killed 200 people and led to the collapse of the previous government. In El Salvador, a 29-year-old woman sent to prison for having a stillbirth has been released on conditional freedom after 6 years. In 2014, Cindy Arazo suffered an obstetric emergency. Unaware she was 8 months pregnant, she woke up handcuffed to a hospital bed, accused of having an abortion and charged with aggravated homicide. El Salvador has long criminalized abortions with a total ban since 1998. Dozens have been convicted and imprisoned after having miscarriages and stillbirths. Young climate activists around the world staged thousands of protest strikes and other actions Friday for a global day of climate action. In Uganda, activist Vanessa Nakati, who launched the Fridays for Future climate strike in Uganda, led a march in Kampala.
This is a personal issue because many people are dying, many people are suffering, ecosystems are collapsing, our life support systems are being destroyed. That is why I speak up and demand for action, because I want to see change, because I want to have a future.
Here in New York City, activists projected anti-colonialist and environmental messages on the Manhattan headquarters of KKR overnight, calling out the private equity firm over its investment in Coastal GasLink, a $4.7 billion pipeline in Western Canada. It's part of a day of action against KKR in solidarity with Wet'suwet'en First Nation land defenders who are in protracted battle to protect their territory from construction of the 400-mile natural gas pipeline. Protesters are also demanding KKR divest from Safariland, a major producer of tear gas and other crowd control weapons. In California, firefighters struggled to contain more than two dozen major fires as hot weather and gusty dry winds fanning existing flames and spark new blazes overnight. The latest fires in Northern California's Napa and Shasta counties have consumed some 10,000 acres, destroying wine vineyards and homes and prompting evacuation orders. As California enters the peak of its historic fire season, a record-shattering 3.4 million acres have already burned. Climate scientists warn greenhouse gas emissions have led to searing record heat and an enduring drought that's dried out vegetation and left Californians vulnerable to explosive fires. This comes as Stanford University researchers found at least 1,200 people and as many as 3,000 died as a result of inhaling toxic smoke that's blanketed California in recent weeks. A federal judge ruled Friday Trump's head of public lands has been serving in his role unlawfully, blocking him from carrying on in his position. William Perry Pendley has been the acting director of the Interior Department's Bureau of Land Management for the past year, allowing him to bypass Senate confirmation. The Interior Department said it would appeal the ruling. Last month, 300 organizations signed on to a letter calling on the Senate to reject Pendley as head of the Bureau of Land Management, highlighting his, quote, radical anti-science and anti-conservation positions, unquote, which include once calling the Endangered Species Act a joke. He's also repeatedly attacked immigrant, indigenous, and communities of color. A federal judge Sunday ordered an 11th-hour injunction halting Donald Trump's executive order banning the smartphone app TikTok, owned by the Chinese company ByteDance, from online stores in the U.S. Trump's ban was due to take effect at midnight as a first step towards a complete U.S. ban on the popular social media platform. That ban is still set to take effect on November 12th. And in Philadelphia, housing activists celebrated an historic victory Friday after city officials agreed to hand over 50 vacant homes to a community land trust following months of organizing by unhoused people, including protest encampments and taking over vacant homes. 50 mothers and children who've been occupying 15 vacant city-owned houses will also be permitted to stay as part of the deal. Philadelphia Housing Action, the group behind the direct action campaign, will set up the community land trust. Sterling Johnson, an organizer with Black and Brown Workers Cooperative, welcomed the news but stressed it's only a first step, saying, quote, there was already a major housing crisis in Philadelphia, and we anticipate a wave of mass evictions on top of that due to COVID-19. The scale of the housing crisis would require thousands of new units of low-income housing. This is only the beginning, he said. To see our interview with Sterling Johnson, go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show looking at the bombshell report in the New York Times that reveals Donald Trump paid no federal income taxes in 10 of the last 15 years. And he paid just $750 in federal income taxes in both 2016 and 2017. The Times published the report after obtaining more than two decades of Trump's tax return data. On Sunday, Trump called the report fake news, but he continues to refuse to release his tax returns. The reporting paints a picture of Trump as either inept entrepreneur or a criminal tax cheat. For years, he's reported massive losses in some of his key business projects, including more than $300 million in his golf courses and $55 million in his hotel in Washington, D.C. He's used the losses to offset his taxable income in other areas. The New York Times also reveals the president has been locked in a battle over taxes with the IRS over a $73 million tax refund he claimed after his casino business in Atlantic City collapsed. Trump could be forced to pay over $100 million if he loses that fight. In addition, the Times reports Trump has more than $300 million in loans he personally guaranteed that will soon come due. The Trump family also reduced its tax bill by paying nearly $750,000 in so-called consulting fees to Ivanka Trump while she was an employee of the Trump Organization. Former Department of Justice Inspector General Michael Bromwich responded to the report by writing on Twitter, quote, Trump knew something we didn't when he started balking at the peaceful transfer of power. If he loses the election, he faces federal and state prosecution for bank fraud, tax fraud, wire fraud, and mail fraud, as does his entire family. No OLC memo will spare him, he said. The New York Times also reports how President Trump has earned millions of dollars in overseas licensing deals since entering the White House, including $3 million from the Philippines, over $2 million from India, and $1 million from Turkey. In 2017, Trump paid just $750 in federal income taxes in the United States, but he and his businesses paid nearly $157,000 in taxes to the Philippines and $145,000 in taxes to India. We begin today's show with Ellie Mistel, the nation's justice correspondent, author of the magazine's new monthly column, Objection. He's reported on the legal fight over Trump's tax returns. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Ellie. Can you talk about the significance of this bombshell report in the New York Times?
Yeah, it's a doozy. Look, I go back on this to Michael Cohen, Trump's former lawyer and fixer's testimony before Congress. Michael Cohen told us all what the game is. He said that Trump inflates his assets when it helps him, for instance, to get on the Forbes richest people in the world list, and he deflates his assets when it helps him, for instance, to hide his income on his tax returns. Michael Cohen testified to this in front of Congress. Now, the tax documents that were leaked to the New York Times and they reported on do not prove Michael Cohen's story. But if Michael Cohen was telling the truth, this is what the tax documents would look like.
So you tweeted last night, the thing about the tax leak is that while tax avoidance is legal, tax evasion is not. Explain.
So, I mean, look, at certain high levels, and this is a thing that we fight about a lot politically, but at certain levels of the economy, there are all sorts of tricks wealthy people can do to avoid paying taxes. It's one of the reasons why tax lawyers are so smart and well paid, right? There are tricks. There are things that you can do. Decreasing your taxable income with losses from one side of the ledger to offset huge gains on another side of the ledger is, you know, commonplace. There are various tax avoidance schemes that are legal, that are perfectly legal. We can argue about whether or not they should be legal, but it is clear that they are legal, right? To make it work, you kind of just have to be really bad at something. Trump happens to be really bad at business, according to these documents, and that is how he is able to fritter away something along the lines of $434 million he earned from The Apprentice and other licensing deals. That's tax avoidance 101 if what he's saying in the documents is absolutely true.
So,
however,
go ahead.
However, there's also the possibility that the tax documents are fraudulent. And if they're fraudulent, there's a lot of suggestion here that what we could be looking at is not tax avoidance. It could be the Michael Cohen allegation of tax evasion, which is, in fact, a crime.
So on Sunday night, President Trump held a news conference right as the New York Times was dropping their bombshell report.
It's fake news. It's totally fake news. Made up, fake. We went through the same stories. You could have asked me the same questions 4 years ago. I had to litigate this and talk about it. Totally fake news. No, actually, I paid tax. And you'll see that as soon as my tax returns. It's under audit. And they've been under audit for a long time.
So, Ellie Mistel, you tweeted last night, there's something he could do to prove this.
He could just release his tax returns, which he has promised to do multiple times throughout the course of his presidency. This audit excuse is now known to everybody, right? We know what the audit is about. It's the $95 million he paid in taxes to the IRS that he then got a $72.9 million refund on later. That's what the audit's about. Everybody knows that now. Great, we're done. So now he can just release his taxes, right? Like he just don't go to his file cabinet, you know, open the drawer and send out his 2019 tax returns if he is calling this fake news. Like, we can't just accept anymore this blanket fake news story. What exactly is fake, President Trump? Is it fake that you paid your daughter $750,000 while she was an employee, potentially to lower your tax bill? Is it fake that you called your Westchester property in Bedford, New York, a business and wrote off $2.2 million in property taxes as business expenses? Is that fake, or did you actually do that? Because those are the questions now. We don't have to just take his word for the fact that he paid lots of taxes. We can see in the documents that he didn't. And if those documents are wrong, Donald Trump can release his taxes and show us what he claims is the real truth.
The New York Times says this time around, he's personally responsible for loans and other debts totaling $421 million, with most of it coming due within 4 years. Should he win re-election, his lenders could be placed in the unprecedented position of weighing whether to foreclose on a sitting president. He owes $421 million, Ellie Mistel.
And we don't know to who. Like, that is the thing. Like, of all the stories here, some of it is just kind of hilarious of incompetence on Trump's part. Some of it is perhaps criminal tax evasion. The outstanding loans is a threat to American sovereignty. And I am not being hyperbolic when I say that. One of the reasons why we find large amounts of outstanding debt disqualifying for many positions in the federal government is that it's a hook into corruption, right? Like the people who you owe money to might have leverage over you as you execute your duties. The fact that he owes this much money, the fact that we don't even know who he owes the money to, and the fact that he apparently, according to his taxes, has no legitimate way of paying the money, all makes him a compromised person. And for a compromised person to be running the American government is a kind of textbook bad thing that counterterrorism experts and the like have warned us about from the beginning with this man. So from a governmental kind of integrity of government perspective, the outstanding loan money is actually the biggest story for people to focus on.
And the New York Times is promising to publish more stories, and the first debate between him and Joe Biden is Tuesday night. Ellie Mistal, stay with us, because we're going to move to another top story this weekend, and that is President Trump's nomination of Amy Coney Barrett to be justice on the Supreme Court. Stay with us. Instrumental version of Beautiful Liar by Beyoncé. This is Democracy Now!, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump has nominated the conservative federal judge Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court to fill Ruth Bader Ginsburg's seat. Barrett is a 48-year-old former Notre Dame law professor who clerked for the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. On Saturday, Barrett spoke alongside President Trump at the White House.
I clerked for Justice Scalia more than 20 years ago, but the lessons I learned still resonate. His judicial philosophy is mine, too. A judge must apply the law as written. Judges are not policymakers, and they must be resolute in setting aside any policy views they might hold.
Senate Democrats have slammed Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell for proceeding on Barrett's nomination so close to the election in 2016. McConnell refused to hold confirmation hearings for Merrick Garland, President Obama's pick to replace Scalia, who had died nearly 9 months before the election. At the time, McConnell said, quote, the American people should have a voice in the selection of their next Supreme Court justice, unquote. But now Republicans are racing to get Barrett confirmed at a time when early voting has already begun. In some states, the Senate Judiciary Committee plans to start Barrett's confirmation hearing on October 12th. A full Senate vote could occur as soon as October 22nd. If Barrett's confirmed by Election Day, she'll immediately take part in a major case that could determine the future of the Affordable Care Act. On November 10th, the oral arguments will be heard. 3 years ago, she wrote a law review article criticizing Chief Justice John Roberts upholding the ACA, writing, quote, Chief Justice Roberts pushed the Affordable Care Act beyond its plausible meaning to save the statute, unquote. Well, on Sunday, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden criticized Trump's nomination of Barrett.
There's no mystery about what's happening here. President Trump is trying to throw out the Affordable Care Act, and he's been trying to do it for the last 4 years.
Amy Coney Barrett could also help decide who wins the presidential election. Last week, Trump said he expects the election to end up before the Supreme Court, saying that's why he's pushing the Senate to rapidly confirm a replacement for Ginsburg. 20 years ago, Barrett worked with George W. Bush's legal team on the contested Florida recount. Two other future Supreme Court justices at the time, John Roberts and Brett Kavanaugh, also helped Bush's team, which actively worked to stop a recount. Amy Coney Barrett has a record of taking conservative stances on abortion, gun rights and immigration. She once called abortion always immoral. The Human Rights Campaign has called her an absolute threat to LGBTQ rights. During her confirmation hearing, Senate Democrats are also expected to ask questions about her membership in a secretive Catholic group called People of Praise. Members of the group pledge a lifelong loyalty oath to the group, which assigns each member a personal advisor known as Heads for Men, and until recently, Handmaids for Women. In a moment, we're going to Alexis McGill Johnson, president and CEO of Planned Parenthood. But we are staying with Ellie Mistel for a few minutes right now, the nation's justice correspondent. Ellie, you wrote a piece that is headlined, "Amy Coney Barrett is an extremist, just not the kind you think." Explain.
Yeah, so there are a lot of people who kind of started where you ended, Amy, where they kind of focus on her religious conservatism and her, you know, her membership in this group. And the fact that she has written extensive law review articles about what Catholic judges should do and shouldn't do while on the bench. And so people have kind of focused in on the religious conservatism of her nomination. And I just wanted to focus people on the issue that her religious conservatism is not what's extreme about her. It's her actual judicial opinions. In fact, she only uses the religion card, the religion angle, when it serves her particular purpose in terms of policy against, you know, abortion rights or LGBTQ rights. Overall, she does not use her religion to guide her through her decisions. She uses her extremist conservative views to guide her through her decision. It's not a religious position to deny people seeking public assistance a green card. It's Amy Coney Barrett's position to do that. That's her deal. It's not a religious position to ignore the deliberate indifference to human life when a prison guard shoots shotgun shells into a crowded cafeteria. That's Amy Coney Barrett's position to ignore the deliberate indifference to human life. So she has a bunch of extreme conservative positions that make her a problematic nominee far beyond her religious affiliations and whatever. Quite frankly, I don't care about her religion. I care about her decisions.
Of course, she can also weigh in on the election if, in fact, the presidential election goes to the Supreme Court.
Yes, to be clear, Donald Trump could have nominated Atticus Finch and I would oppose the nominee because having a nominee to take office in the middle of an election. I mean, people are saying like, oh, right before the election. It's not right before the election. The election has started. People are voting, right? So what Trump is trying to do is pick his own judge in a contested election about his own presidency that, as we talked about in the last second, he kind of has to win or else he's going to jail, right? So that is not how the system of laws and government is supposed to work. So there is no person that I think Trump should be allowed to nominate in these circumstances because of the election issue and because of the timing of the nomination. Amy Coney Barrett is... of the people that Trump could have nominated, Amy Coney Barrett is one of the most extreme people that he could have nominated, as opposed to a kind of moderate, middle-of-the-road person. And so, obviously, I think there's a lot of justified concern that if she gets to the court, she will be a fifth vote in favor of handing Donald Trump the presidency.
We're going to talk with Alexis McGill Johnson, head of Planned Parenthood, in just a minute about abortion and Obamacare, which is going before the Supreme Court on November 10th. But I wanted to ask you, Ellie, about one major case set to come before the court, Fulton versus Philadelphia, which involves religious freedom and gay rights that could have much broader implications. The case brought by Catholic Social Services, a faith-based group, which refuses the placement of foster children to same-sex couples. The group was one of 30 agencies that the city of Philadelphia contracted with to place abused and neglected children in foster homes. But the city ended the contract after learning that CSS denied placement of children with same-sex couples. And the charity then sued Philadelphia, citing a violation of free religious exercise and free speech if they were forced to provide services to LGBTQ couples. Oral arguments scheduled for November 4th. Explain the significance of this case.
This is one of the most important cases on the Supreme Court docket, and it goes right to the heart of LGBTQ rights and LGBTQ adoption privileges. But it also goes to the heart of a new and, I think, dangerous trend in our First Amendment jurisprudence. The First Amendment's protection of freedom of religion is supposed to be a shield, right? It's supposed to protect me, a religious observer, to allow me to act and support my faith in the privacy of my own home and in my public space. What the religious right is trying to do to the First Amendment is to change it from a shield to protect people to a sword to go after people who don't agree with their preferred religion, right? Like that's completely flipping the First Amendment on its head. And so what the issue in this Fulton County case is the group who discriminates against gay people in adoption. That's just what they do. And they're allowed to do that because that's freedom of religion means freedom to hate people that you don't like, and so they can hate them or whatever. But what they want to do is to force the city of Philadelphia to adopt that discrimination, to adopt that bigotry, and make it part of city policy by allowing them to continue to place foster children who are wards of the state based on the Catholic Service's bigoted decision-making in terms of who is able to adopt. Now, so it's a critically important case for those reasons. The problem is, and the reason why Amy Coney Barrett doesn't, to me, so much play into this, is that liberals were going to lose that case already. There aren't five votes against this kind of corruption of the First Amendment. I don't know that with Ruth Bader Ginsburg passing away, I don't know that there were two votes. Because in the past, cases like this version of the First Amendment, both Justices Stephen Breyer and Elena Kagan have joined the religious conservatives for this, I think, corruption of the First Amendment. So with RBG gone, I really think it's going to be an 8-1 case with only Sonia Sotomayor standing opposed.
Ellie, we just have 30 seconds. What do you think Democrats should be doing right now?
Everything except for adding legitimacy to the process. You cannot go to these hearings. You cannot add your voice to these processes. You have to do everything you can to delay and then win the White House and win the Senate and expand the court, because that's the only way, that's the only thing that you can do.
Ellie Mistal is Nation's justice correspondent. As we continue our coverage of President Trump's nomination of Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court, we turn now to look at how her confirmation poses a threat to reproductive rights. On Sunday, President Trump appeared on Fox and Friends and was asked about the future of Roe v. Wade.
Do you think a 6-3 court with three of your picks on there, Mr. President, would potentially rule on a life issue, on a Roe issue?
It's certainly possible, and maybe they do it in a different way. Maybe they give it back to the states. You just don't know what's going to happen.
Maybe they give it back to the states. You just don't know what's going to happen. Let's go to Alexis McGill-Johnson, president and CEO of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America, Planned Parenthood Action Fund as well. Her recent op-ed in USA Today headlined, "Amy Coney Barrett won't stand up for women the way Ruth Bader Ginsburg did." Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Alexis McGill-Johnson. Can you respond to what Trump just said? So throw it back to the states.
Yeah, I mean, look, we certainly know that Justice Barrett would be a huge threat to reproductive rights. She's been an active and vocal critic of Roe v. Wade and suggested that it was settled wrongly. And we also know that there are 17 cases that are a case away from the Supreme Court that could overturn, if not irrevocably create restrictions around access to abortion. So what it would mean is that if Roe were overturned, that there would be some states where if you decided you wanted to expand your family, those would be within your domain of decisions that you would be making with your partner, with your, and with your medical provider. And in other states, you would essentially be forced into pregnancy if you didn't have the resources to access abortion. So I think that those are the the challenges that we are facing here. And I also think that, you know, just to tie it back to the other conversation you were having around healthcare, you know, reproductive healthcare is healthcare. And the most immediate threat that we are facing in the time of a pandemic is the fact that the ACA, which has been one of the biggest advancements for women's health across the board, is also under attack. And the threat of that, I think, in combination with the impact that could have on abortion access, is really significant with this judge.
Hmm. I mean, this is absolutely critical because the ACA is going to the Supreme Court on November 10th. Not clear whether Trump's nominee will be seated at that point. But talk about the issues at stake. If yes. Obamacare was struck down, we have just passed two crisis numbers, 200,000 deaths from COVID-19 and 7 million, over 7 million infections. We're talking about how many more millions of people will be suffering from pre-existing conditions alone. Can you talk about all of this?
Yeah, first of all, we don't even know enough about coronavirus, right? We're just trying to focus right now on how not to get it. But I mean, we don't know the long-term impact of that. So coronavirus itself is a pre-existing condition. And, you know, the other things that ACA afforded us were, you know, Medicaid expansion for women. It guaranteed birth control coverage. It guaranteed that there wouldn't be discrimination, that women wouldn't have to pay more for our health care than men. And, you know, and for many of us, you know, we who have been able to take advantage of our older children being able to stay on our health plans until age 26. There have been lots of ways in which that has actually created and expanded access to health care for many Americans. And what's at stake is that almost 30 million Americans could lose health insurance at a time, you know, again, when we were in a pandemic. And so I think when you look at the conversations that Americans are having right now, first of all, they're saying this confirmation should wait until after inauguration. And they're also saying, like, if you have this time to rush through a confirmation of a justice and hold these hearings as a Senate, why don't you have the same amount of time to rush through COVID relief, to think about comprehensive COVID testing so that we can all actually restore a little bit more of a new normalcy around getting back to work and our schools?
And the issue of Roe v. Wade. Exactly what is Judge Amy Coney Barrett's record on choice and contraception?
Yeah, again, I think that Judge Barrett has been, has been very critical of how Roe v. Wade was decided. She believes that abortion is always immoral. She has, you know, suggested that she would from the bench, she would judge based on the Constitution and the law. But yet she writes one thing and says the other. We know that in her writings, particularly about the impact of what it means to be a Catholic judge, is that judges, when they don't believe in the law because of their personal beliefs, that they should not uphold the law. So the real threat that we are seeing is the impact that she could actually use her personal beliefs to undermine rights for millions of people seeking abortion. And if Roe is overturned, we know that there will be 25 million women of reproductive age in states that would have to travel outside of their own states to access basic reproductive health care, to access health care. We already saw it also, Amy, during COVID, you know, that I think was an important precursor for what could possibly happen when a lot of these same states that have trigger laws would, you know, essentially those governors created executive orders banning access to abortion, saying it wasn't time sensitive, a procedure. And so we saw people getting in their cars. We saw them driving, you know, upwards of 16 hours from Texas to Colorado to California, just to get access, in some cases, just to medication abortion. So we already know what it looks like, right? We know that people will not stop having abortions. They were just putting in a much more significant burden on their ability to access one.
Alexis McGill-Johnson, what do you think Democrats should do right now?
Look, I agree with the previous guest. I think that, you know, we need to put it all on the line for this judge. We have to ensure that we are pushing this nomination until the inauguration. That is what the majority of Americans want. And I think that the Senate Democrats should do exactly that, that they should not participate in the process. They should not give this legitimacy. And, and to the extent that we can push this to where the American people want this nomination to happen, I think that would be the most important thing right now.
And I know there's a whole battle within the community, the pro-choice community. And we should say, and I wanted to ask you about this, the vast majority of people in this country are pro-choice, and that includes Catholics. But the Supreme Court and a number of legislatures around the country, to say the least, are not. What about this this division?
Look, I think this is about essentially a power grab that has happened over the last decade that really does thwart the will of the people, right? We have, since the 2010 Congress and the gerrymandering that happened subsequently, we have seen a number of state legislatures across the country where a vocal minority has the levers of power. And there is no state. It's not just the national numbers that 77% of Americans support Roe as the law of the land. You know, there is no state in the country where people don't believe that Roe should be the law of the land. So, you know, the idea that we have all of these states that are not reflecting the will of the people, we now have a judiciary that has been remade under Mitch McConnell, where over 200 justices have been placed onto the court. And, in incredibly conservative ways, some of them whom don't even believe in IVF, much less in access to abortion. And I think those are the things that we are very concerned about. So I think it's really important to think about the kind of, ultimate power grab of now trying to seat a justice on the Supreme Court who also does not believe that Roe was correctly decided and believes that abortion is immoral, and how that will tilt the balance of the court completely out of sync with where the American people are.
Alexis McGill-Johnson, we want to thank you for being with us, President and CEO of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America and the Planned Parenthood Action Fund. Next up, we look at new body cam footage raising questions about the investigation into the police killing of Breonna Taylor. Stay with us. Wants to See You by Adam Taylor. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. After nearly 200 days of protests calling for justice for Breonna Taylor, the 26-year-old African-American woman shot to death in her own apartment by plainclothes Louisville officers serving a no-knock warrant, new evidence is raising troubling questions about the integrity of the crime scene after the raid and the investigation that followed. On Thursday, a grand jury failed to charge any of the three white Louisville police officers involved in the killing of Breonna Taylor with her death. Kentucky's governor, Louisville's mayor, have joined calls to release the grand jury transcripts. Vice News has obtained body camera footage from Louisville Metro Police Department officers and SWAT team members from the night of the raid that raises questions about the investigation. On Saturday, Vice posted a clip that shows former Detective Brett Hankison, one of the three officers who fired their guns and the only one now facing charges. He's facing charges of first-degree wanton endangerment for gunshots, not that hit Breonna Taylor's apartment or her, but that hit a neighboring apartment. In the footage, Hankison can be seen entering Taylor's apartment while investigators are there examining the crime scene. At one point in the footage, Hankison asks about a shell casing on the ground, saying, "That's theirs?" before an unidentified officer tells him to leave until the PIU, the Public Integrity Unit, arrives. This is the clip.
"That's theirs?
No, it's ours, it looks like. Theirs is in there. But I'd back out until they get PIU in here. So.
I just didn't know if there are any guns visible.
We did not see any."
video footage also shows Detective Hankison lingers in Taylor's apartment even after he's told to leave the scene of the active investigation of an officer-involved shooting in which he is one of the officers. It also shows that none of the officers who were part of the raid got separated or paired with an escort. This comes as a ballistics report from the Kentucky State Police was unable to determine that Taylor's boyfriend, Kenneth Walker, shot Officer Jonathan Mattingly, as he has been claimed to have done by the Kentucky Attorney General, or if Mattingly was hit by friendly fire. During the raid, Walker fired a warning shot at the front door and said he believed it was a home invasion. He didn't know who was raiding his apartment. He even called the police to ask for help. He has a license to carry firearms. Meanwhile, the footage from the body cameras appears to corroborate several parts of Walker's testimony. Walker says when officers arrested him, they threatened to set a dog on him and told him he'd spend the rest of his life in jail. This is a clip from the body camera footage of his arrest.
Walk straight back, or I'll send this dog on you. Walk back to my voice. Walk back, or I'll send this dog. Walk back to me. Keep on walking. Walk now. Walk. Walk back to me. Watch out.
We're joined by part of the team that obtained this footage. Roberto Ferdman is a Vice News correspondent. His latest co-authored piece, headline, New Body Cam Footage, raises questions about Breonna Taylor death investigation. He's just back from Louisville, joining us from New York. Welcome, Roberto, to Democracy Now! Tell us who is shouting this right now and talk about the significance of this footage. I think most people listening or watching right now are saying, wait a second, I thought there was no footage that the officers who engaged in this no-knock raid did not have body cam cameras.
So you're right. From the very beginning, the police department and the city have maintained that none of the officers who executed the search warrant were wearing body cameras because they're part of a unit called the Criminal Interdiction Division, and they often perform their duties in plain clothes, as they were that night. And up until then, because since the policy has been changed, they didn't have to wear body cameras. That being said, there are many officers and SWAT team members who arrive on scene immediately afterward. And all of those officers, most of them are uniformed, have to wear body cameras, had to at the time, and were wearing body cameras. So we acquired about 45 different body cameras. I mean, it's many, many hours of footage. Some of these are 30 minutes long, or many of them are. And we sifted through those. The video of where you see Kenneth Walker being arrested, walking backwards, that's the body camera of a canine officer who comes over to kind of rush Walker to walk backwards faster. The other body cameras from one of the SWAT team members. There are probably about 10 others, and we're working toward more stories at the moment to help folks show what can be gleaned from those videos and from other documents
and
as well.
Explain who's screaming at him and who also was captured on camera saying to him, Kenny Walker, this is Breonna's boyfriend, screaming at him, you're going to spend the rest of your time, rest of your life in jail, and threatening to sick the dog on him?
So the officer who's threatening to sick the dog on him is an LMPD officer whose last name, I believe, is Nimono. The person who tells Kenny that he's going to spend the rest of his life in jail is Brett Hankison, one of the three officers LMPD says fired their weapon that night, and who was fired over the summer. I believe it was at the beginning of July. But Hankison is not just the officer who tells Kenny that he's going to spend the rest of his life in jail. He's also the officers, as you pointed out, who can be seen inside of the apartment. He walks up to the front door immediately after SWAT clears the apartment, leaves, and then comes back and steps into the apartment. None of this is supposed to happen. In fact, what is supposed to happen is very far from it. All the officers who are involved in any critical incident, especially officer-involved shootings, are supposed to be separated immediately and paired with what's called a peer support officer, someone who brings them over, puts them, for instance, like in the back of a car so that they don't speak to other people, so that they don't involve themselves in the crime scene. But, you know, these things don't seem to have been enforced, these policies, and it is so flagrant in some instances that one of the officers, Mike Campbell, he's one of the seven who executes the raid, actually ends up interviewing neighbors, witnesses, and not only can be seen on video walking down the stairs, having come from upstairs in that unit to speak to neighbors there, he tells investigators in an interview that he does it, and they don't say anything of it. They don't flinch. We haven't heard back from the department on what they make of that, or why they haven't pointed that out, or why the officer hasn't been punished.
So I want to go to this point about the witnesses. When Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron announced that no charges would be brought in direct connection with Breonna Taylor's death, he emphasized the officers who carried out the search warrant did identify themselves at Taylor's door and noted there was a witness who corroborated the officer's version of events. This is Cameron.
Evidence shows that officers both knocked and announced their presence at the apartment. The officer's statements about their announcement are corroborated by an independent witness who was near in a proximity to apartment 4. In other words, the warrant was not served as a no-knock warrant. When officers were unable to get anyone to answer or open the door to apartment 4, the decision was made to breach the door.
So that's the Kentucky Attorney General. But according to audio and documents obtained by your news organization, Vice News, that same witness changed his story in months following the raid. In this clip, Vice published this weekend, we hear the original answer given by the only witness who claims to have heard the police identify themselves that night.
Did you ever hear anyone identify themselves as police?
Nobody identified himself.
This is the witness, is that right, that the Attorney General identified as the one who said the police did identify themselves as police, Roberto?
This is the witness, yes. This is the key witness. As we and other news organizations have pointed out, us as early as July, we spoke to over a dozen neighbors, including neighbors within that unit. We didn't speak to Mr. Sarpy at the time. We tried, but failed in reaching him. None of the neighbors that we spoke to, including one who lived in the unit, say that they heard police announce themselves. And the Attorney General hangs quite a bit on them announcing themselves. The importance of this, even if they did have permission for a no-knock warrant, is that when you execute a no-knock warrant, it's important that you immediately breach the door and go in. Because if you're knocking loudly on someone's door and you're not announcing yourself, that creates a very dangerous scenario where someone is alerted to people being at the door. They don't know whom it is. I think that anyone can agree that it's fair to assume it could be an intruder, as Kenneth Walker says he believed it was. But the Attorney General only presents what Mr. Sarpy says in the second interview that's recorded with the Public Integrity Unit at LMPD. He does not share that the first time they speak with Mr. Sarpy, which is on March 21st, a little over a week after the raid that killed Breonna Taylor, he has a different story. He says that he did not hear anyone. He says he did not hear anyone announce themselves. The only way he could tell that they were police was because he saw the word police on their vest, the bulletproof vest that they were wearing. And this is significant. I mean, especially given how little information has been shared with the public. Before we started releasing stories, and the way in which all of this was represented or presented to the public by the Attorney General's office last Wednesday, when he shared the result of the long-awaited investigation.
Mm. You also wrote a piece headlined, "Initial Police Report Didn't Conclude Breonna Taylor's Boyfriend Shot a Cop in the Leg." And this is key. I mean, even if he did, you have this situation where he didn't know it was cops. He was calling the police saying, help us. But what about this?
So this is important because it's a theme that the Attorney General brings up himself in explaining that they don't know for sure whether or not any of Brett Hankison's bullets hit Breonna Taylor. There were differences in ballistics reports, and he says that, therefore, it is inconclusive. That's part of why they were not able to charge Brett Hankison with wanton endangerment for bullets into Breonna Taylor's apartment, for endangering Breonna Taylor. It is unclear to us, and we broke this story on Friday, why then he also did not present, why he presented Kenneth Walker hitting or firing the shot that hit Mattingly as inconclusive as well. He said in the press conference that it's because the bullet that was recovered was a 9mm. But the difference between a 9mm and what is normally shot with a 40 caliber weapon is very, very small. And the bullet was, and the bullet was mangled. So we believe that it's inconclusive and that the public deserves more information to understand what we know for sure and what we don't and why things.
Roberto Ferdman, I want to say thank you so much. We're going to continue to follow this. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.